Welcome to the Montefiore Einstein Health Technology Innovation Podcast Series. Today, we'll be playing a previous recording from an Innovation Biodesign Seminar.
And first, I'd love to introduce Dr. Mark Gibber. So Dr. Mark Gibber is an associate professor and director of general otolaryngology in the Department of Otolaryngology, Head and Neck Surgery at Montefiore. Dr. Gibber has been engaged in multiple aspects of digital health and medical device innovation, both on the investor and founder side. Dr. Gibber is an investor and advisor in a family-backed venture fund focused on emerging digital health and devices. He's founder of Sigma Surgical, a technology company that created a cloud-based application to aggregate and analyze OR data to determine optimal surgical protocols for increasing the speed, efficiency, and success rates of surgical procedures. Dr. Gibber is a former director of research and development of the Montefiore Einstein Center for Innovation Simulation, as is an expert in the use of simulation, virtual reality, augmented reality, and artificial intelligence to enhance the quality and success of medical procedures and patient care. He has published extensively in the use of innovative technology in medicine and has given numerous lectures on the use of technology in medical education and patient care. Dr. Gibber received his MD from the Albert Einstein College of Medicine and completed his training in otolaryngology, head and neck surgery at Montefiore. So Mark, thank you so much for joining. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Sunidhan. I have to say, you know, I think we've been discussing this fellowship since its infancy stage, and it's amazing to see, you know, even in these difficult times, how far along it's come and how, you know, these ideas are all just really wonderful ideas. And I'm excited to see what the future holds. And, you know, I really commend you and all the fellows for their, you know, really innovative and wonderful ideas. And, you know, like I said, it's going to be great to see what comes out of it as we go along. So I'm going to, I do slides just because it helps me navigate myself. So I'm going to share my screen here, if that's all right. Okay. So, you know, as Sunidhan was saying, so it's an honor to share the panel with, you know, two really accomplished founders and people within the digital health field. And, you know, when I was discussing with Sunidhan, just in terms of what he wanted me to talk about, he hinted at the fact that, you know, the digital health side of it and the founder side of it, I think it was covered pretty well in this seminar. And after seeing who my fellow panelists were, I certainly understand why. You know, certainly two really wonderful founders, and the companies that they founded and have built up speak for themselves. And so I think that, you know, for me, for the time that I have, I think what I can maybe, you know, add a little value to is in terms of my experience, both coming from the founder side of Sigma, which I'm very proud of. You know, again, we're not quite at the stage as the other companies you'll hear about tonight, but, you know, the work we're doing, the work led by Evan Garfine, who's the chief plastic surgery at Montefiore, and the team of Sigma and Manifest, I really do think that it's going to change the way we think about surgery and how we protocolize surgery and how we can kind of standardize surgery. So I'm really proud of that work. But I think that what I am personally more invested in with my time and what I'm a little bit more passionate about, and I think can be a little have a little bit more to say is in terms of my advisor and as an investor when it comes to digital health and devices, because I am very actively involved with that through a family-backed venture fund that has gotten off the ground over the last couple of years. And, you know, it's really a lot of seeing so much exciting stuff and kind of taking the look from the outside in. I think I can give a little bit more feedback and discuss some of the kind of potpourri items that you need put forth to me in terms of discussing with the group here and kind of attack from the things that I see as problems and some solutions to those problems. So, you know, just some of the problems. And when I think about it, I think problems is probably the wrong word. I think that's a negative word, problems. I think opportunities is probably a better word to use. And some of the opportunities that we have to change the way we think about things, especially, and, you know, one of my areas of real interest is because, as Sunidhan said, my day job is as an academic otolaryngologist. And I'm really passionate about the idea that I think that, and Sunidhan knows this well because I speak to him about this all the time. I'm really passionate about the idea that I think that we're the one industry where really the frontline workers in terms of identifying real on-the-ground problems within the industry we work with are oftentimes not the people that have the ability to see the solutions through, create the solutions and create and see those through. And I think there's several reasons for that, but I'm really passionate about the idea of creating, especially within the digital health and device space, more synergistic working relationship between academia and the commercial, industrial, and financial partners. So some of the issues to address are the value proposition, academia versus industry in general, tech transfer and the black hole, and that's no shot at the tech transfer offices because I think they do wonderful work. Again, I'll talk more about that as I get there, and appropriate leadership of companies. So just in terms of value proposition, so some of the challenges that we face, I think when we're talking about a traditional tech startup is, and I always like to use personal experiences. So my wife is a tech startup founder, and her company was acquired last year by a much larger company. And in preparing all the decks and the documents in terms of going out and pitching the company when it became apparent that they were that there was acquisition interest, it was a very direct revenue model for her company and for many companies like her. B2B, B2C, where there's a direct revenue model and direct line of revenue generation. And that's not always the case in healthcare, right? So, and one of the other traditional tech startup points is that, we oftentimes are dealing with industries where they have fully integrated data analytics. And I know that, this might be difficult to see, it might be difficult to sell this point when I'm on a panel with a founder from a company like Renalytics, but I do think that in healthcare right now, we are still a little bit behind in terms of our acceptance of data analytics, our incorporation of it into our everyday care. And there's multiple reasons for that. But I do think that as opposed to traditional tech startups who have fully integrated data analytics systems, we're not quite there yet. And so on the digital health device side, I think one of the challenges often is that while in the traditional tech startup, I think you could have, these really crazy ideas that, again, you just hear them and you're like, that doesn't make any sense at all. While in digital health and devices, one thing I will say is that if you hear 100 pitches and 100 ideas, every idea is pretty much a good idea. I mean, conceptually, idealistically, it makes sense, right? I mean, people have altruistic visions in terms of why they're creating these ideas and what they want to do with them. So every idea in healthcare is often good because you're trying to improve patient care, you're trying to improve patient engagement, whatever it is. But that doesn't make it a good company, right? And so it's identifying market size need. Your consumer in healthcare is oftentimes very risk averse and cost conscious, more so than in traditional tech startups. And like I said, there's a hesitance towards analytics. So, some of the solutions, and again, in a limited time, we could talk about all these problems. I could personally talk about them for hours and hours, just so you know. But, some of the solutions as we think about our company is to identify a straight line to ROI, right? I mean, that's a really important thing from an investor standpoint. I think, and specifically with digital health, I think that's a challenge, right? Because we have a lot of, there's a lot of algorithmic thinking in terms of if we do this and then do this and do this, we can save money here, right? Well, that oftentimes when you're pitching an idea to, when you're pitching an idea to a consumer, they need to see a more straight line, real time money, cost savings, profit making, ROI on the investment. So I think that it's really important to draw a straight line in terms of what you're conceptually trying to build to how that's going to create an ROI for your consumer, specifically healthcare institutions or payers, whoever that consumer is. And then the other, really important point is that, we are very hesitant, I think, when we are creating companies to get it exactly right before we put it out there. And I think especially in digital health, not so much in devices, but in digital health, it's really important to get early users however possible, get the product out there, get users using it so that you can identify what's working, what's not working. And that will actually help also create that straight line that we're talking about in terms of generating, the ROI. So now, academia versus industry. And, this is a very simple slide, but I think one of the issues that we face and one of the real challenges is that we've kind of taken a deep dive now into this world of digital health and digital technology platforms that we're creating. And yet we're working within the confines of our scientific biosphere that we work with, right? And we know that, you know, in terms of product development, technology development, that is in a much faster timeline than, you know, the typical academic timeline that we work with within, you know, the university biosphere. So I think that that is a real challenge that we have to address, you know, and we have to, first of all, we have to identify that it's a problem. We have to acknowledge that it's a problem. We have to address it, right? Because I think that what this issue, what this slide really shows is that what we're doing in academic institutions, you know, is being done externally at startup firms, R&D firms, you know, entrepreneur, you know, general development of companies. They're doing the same thing, but they're on a much faster timeline. And to get it to turn it into a larger company and get to market faster, we need to keep up with that timeline. And, you know, one of the challenges is overcoming the pharma model that, and I try to stay as far away as from pharma as possible. There's people a lot smarter than me who are in the pharma game. And you know, one of the things that I find challenging about it is the timeline. But from an academic standpoint, we really are, you know, we have years of experience with the pharma model, which is that there's significant institutional equity. There's oftentimes significant institutional support. The process of pharma development allows for slow development because that is, you know, again, it takes a long time to get molecules and drugs out. And in the industry timeline, you know, is pretty similar to the academic timeline. Even in, you know, again, private, you know, commercial companies, the, you know, the timeline is similar to what we're doing in academics. That's not the case in a digital and device model, right? So oftentimes, you know, right now, there's this question mark of what the institutional equity should be for digital health and devices. Oftentimes there is minimal institutional support because there's just not that much to offer, quite honestly. We know there's a need for speed. You know, we have to get our devices and our platforms out there quickly or else we're going to be lapped very easily. And the industry timeline is far exceeds the academic timeline. These are major issues, you know, and again, I think it's important that we acknowledge them, recognize that these are issues, and not try to run away from them. So, you know, what am I talking about when I talk about the tech transfer process in the black hole? So, you know, again, we know that, you know, when it comes to tech transfer, there's a lot that, you know, being part of a large institution, having offices like Tech Transfer Office available to us is very valuable, right? There's, you know, there's a lot that they do to help get the process up and going. But it's a complicated process, right? There's patenting, there's agreement administration, there's licensing, royalties, all sorts of stuff that before you get to commercialization. And it's a process. It has stages, phases, typical behaviors. It can be understood at different levels. And obviously, there's very different stakeholders with very different priorities and perspectives. So it's just important, again, to recognize that and have a good open communication process. I'll skip through that because I don't want to take up too much time here. But, you know, again, like I said, there are lots of priorities and different stages, phases, behaviors that take place. There's market pull, there's technology push in terms of what's pushing the idea, you know, and the priority of either the inventor, the tech transfer, the institutional. So, and then of course there are key events and milestones of patent, proof of principle, signing a licensing deal. And the bottom line is the long-term confusing process. It's not a single event and you need to be, you know, it is a long haul. And again, universities and research institutes have the time to be in it for the long haul. Oftentimes founders, inventors, entrepreneurs don't necessarily have that time. So we need to kind of create solutions again that take that into account. What tech transfer is not, it's not research, development, deployment. You know, that's a way too oversimplified model that is just not true. So the black hole that I talk about is really this area where the tech transfer office and the process within an academic institution kind of helps you get your idea off the ground. There's disclosure involved, obviously. There's oftentimes IP help. Places that do it very well will have some seed funding available and get you off the ground with even sometimes more, you know, an angel round and more than just basic seed funding to develop an MVP possible possibly see through to some proof of concept. But then you get into this black hole, and it's through no fault of the institution, because there are financial restraints there, where what are the next steps? What are the next steps for the founder? What are the next steps for the company at that point? Where are you? How long is it taking to get in there? And have you been lapped in the time that it's taken to get to that point? And so I'm a big advocate and big proponent of creating commercial and financial partnerships. And that's really, you know, again, and that's a simple statement that I think everyone would agree with. But I think we have to be much more aggressive in terms of creating these partnerships to almost suck these ideas out of these institutions at a much earlier stage, with licensing and royalty agreements earlier on, to allow them to be placed in the proper hands of people who could actually commercialize these ideas and see them through to be successful companies. Because like I said, if we don't do that, again, they oftentimes these ideas will get killed on the cutting room floor. Business development support, obviously, you know, it's one thing to help with funding, it's one thing to help with some IP help. But oftentimes, you know, there is this challenge, especially with clinician founders, where, you know, we are not by nature business, we are not by nature even entrepreneur driven or business driven. We don't know how to model out startups. And it's really important that we understand early on in the process, when when there's a company that's founded, what the business model is, how to model that out, how to create all those things. So there's got to be greater transparency, I think, from the get-go of what the priorities are, both on the institutional side and the inventor side, and so that we can find that balance for the companies that come out of it. And then finally, appropriate leadership. I think this is a really understated problem that has the potential to be solved within, you know, again, the ecosystem that we're creating within the, you know, healthcare today, which is these companies that we're finding that are being founded within the academic ecosystem. Again, part of the problem, I think, is, like I said, we are not, you know, clinician founders are not built necessarily to take their companies from a, you know, the IP stage and the seed funding stage to, you know, a real Series A, Series B type concept. And I think it's really important to identify early on who are the appropriate leaders for your company, what are the people that you need to bring in, what are the resources, both financially and in terms of personnel, to bring in to lead the companies to see them successfully through. And, you know, one of the questions I always ask is, do you want to keep your day job when we're talking to clinician founders, right? I mean, if you want to continue to be a practicing physician, I know for me, I do. I mean, I want to continue my practice. And so I'm probably not the right person to run a company on a day-to-day basis, because, you know, you can't do that while still doing surgery twice a week and seeing patients twice a week, right? So it's really important to identify what you want your role to be in, and who are the right people to lead the company. And then, can you sell the idea, right? So everyone's got different skill sets. And from an investor standpoint, like I said, there's a lot of good ideas out there, but you know, can you sell the idea? Can you sell the dream? Are you somebody that can go out and raise money? And from an investor standpoint, that's really important. You know, after you've sold me on your really good idea, I want to know that you could actually sell the idea elsewhere, not to other investors, and also to your consumers. And then, does your business model align with your hypothesis? And this comes back to the idea of really, you know, again, keeping that straight line to ROI, right? Because I think that it's really important to identify what, you know, when we're building out these ideas, oftentimes we're creating solutions for problems that we've identified. But is that solution that we're creating, is that a business? Do you have a business in there? So I think it's really important to you make sure that those two things are aligned, so that you can, you know, again, create that straight line to ROI, so that your consumers ultimately will purchase what you're trying to sell. And, you know, again, you can be able to raise money from investors. So those are just some of my thoughts when it comes to starting companies and founding companies, some of the issues that we need to address. And I think it's important in a forum like this, just to get that out in the open, so that we can, again, be more transparent and, you know, discuss these issues and discuss how we can, you know, improve some of these problems and, you know, keep things moving in the right direction. So thanks again, Sunit, and look forward to hearing from everybody else.
Thanks so much, Mark. That was really amazing. Really appreciate it. And thanks for your support, you know, of our program from day one. And I'd like now to introduce Dr. Hillary Hatch. So Dr. Hillary Hatch is a clinical psychologist and a Vice President of Clinical Engagement at Phreesia, where she leads the development of clinical content on Phreesia's platform. She partners with clinical leaders to improve quality performance through the implementation of patient-reported outcomes, screenings, including social determinants, and patient activation modules. Before joining Phreesia, Dr. Hatch was founder and CEO of VitalScore, a digital health company acquired by Phreesia in 2018. She's an instructor of medicine at Johns Hopkins and serves on the faculty of the Psychoanalytic Association of New York, affiliated with NYU Langone Health. She holds a doctorate in clinical psychology from City University of New York, a postdoctoral certificate in psychoanalysis, and a BA from Columbia. Thank you so much, Hillary. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thanks. Thanks for having me here. Mark, I think I have a little bit of PTSD listening to you give your talk, but you're going to see some repetitiveness in my presentation. I think it's definitely goes through point by point some of the pain points you talked about in the process. I'm going to share some slides and hopefully be a bit of a case study for many of the points Mark said that I think rang so incredibly true to me. Can you see my screen? All right. So I think what I wanted to try and do is talk about some things that I thought were really important. And I think I'm a psychologist, so I'm going to go about some of the same things Mark said, but maybe in a slightly different way. For all founders, I always ask them these questions. I say, to look in the mirror and say, how will you feel if you don't found this company or don't pursue this idea? And if your answer isn't, I will hate myself, tear my face off, not be able to live with myself, don't found the company, because it's an extraordinarily hard uphill battle and painful process. And if you can live without doing it, I suggest you do the other things that you do in your life. And I think that goes next to one of, not that it can't be incredibly rewarding. It's just there's so much pain involved, I think, in the process that you have to want to do it so badly to get through those painful moments. And I think one of the things, like Mark said, you have to kind of know who you are. And you have to keep asking yourself this, not just at the beginning of the process, but am I an entrepreneur? Am I an academic or a clinician? You can be all three a little bit, but it's really hard to be a founder of a company unless you get another team to take over the company and still really be a clinician or an academic at the same time. So I think constantly reassessing yourself on these questions are incredibly important, and they help you guide what to do next in your journey. The other thing I often ask founders is what matters most to you? When I tell my story of founding a company, I can certainly talk about each of these points. Next, I think, again, some of the points Mark made from a slightly different angle, really making sure this is especially important in healthcare, where it is so hard to really figure out product market fit and to really be sure that a good idea, because we have so many problems. We have problems coming out of, you know, everywhere we look in healthcare. We've just got so many problems that you have to figure out a problem that that really meets this criteria. You have to know who's going to use the solution that you're building. You have to know who will pay for it, and that they will in fact pay for it. You have to have a plan to scale that solution. And the need needs to be urgent, because it's going to easily, you know, be up against other problems that have much greater priority. I remember once, and I'll talk more again about how this played out in my own story, but one of VitalScore's earliest pilots was with clinicians at Johns Hopkins, and they were incredibly supportive and helpful. And we went and met with the head of the president of the physicians organization, and we said, the piloting physicians really want Epic integration. And the president said to me, look, this year I have to choose between integrating patient photo IDs or integrating a tool that's going to assess for risky use of opioids, you know, painkiller prescriptions, essentially. I have to choose between those two. So you have to know that your solution is going to get priority up with other needs that are going to be incredibly urgent. And then you have to know why others can't do. Why are you unique and why others can't do what you're going to do? And if you're a good entrepreneur, you're delusional on all of these points and you're super excited about it, and that's great. But just you have to go back and keep asking yourself all of these questions. I think it's important, and probably everyone said this, and Dr. Jawali, you've probably done a bunch of seminars about things like, are you a platform or a point solution? But knowing that and understanding the difference is really important, because you can have a great point solution that has incredible outcomes and have a really hard time scaling it because you have to figure out how to fit into workflows. KPIs. So knowing the key performance indicators that you're going to hold yourself up against and say, if we are performing on those things, that tells us that we're moving in the right direction. And it's very easy to keep changing them based on the results that you get, but really deciding what those will be in advance and then seeing what happens in a more, with a little more of a researcher's mentality there than an entrepreneur's is important. I think Mark said this too, knowing who the right co-founders are. I certainly was not the founder that could do all sides of starting a company, because I was really clinical in background, and needed to find business people to partner with. And then knowing the end game, which is where is this idea going to go? If once it grows, and you don't really need to know that from the beginning, but at some point you do need to know that. So putting myself up against these things and telling, my founding story. So I founded a company in 2012 called VitalScore. The goal of that company was to engage patients in their wait time before visits and to try to assess them for unmet social and behavioral health needs, and then get them to talk about those needs in their provider visit. It was really initially kind of a research study that became a digital intervention. And then people said, well, if it's a digital intervention to get funding, you're going to need to found a company. And I sort of went into this, in many ways, sort of backwards. I wasn't really looking to found a company. And so when I go back and put myself sort of to the test here, I did feel like I couldn't live with myself if I didn't do this. It felt so important. I felt my hypothesis was that primary care was a place where so many people went, and they were so influenceable in that moment that there was such an opportunity to do help people and get them on a better path to better health in so many ways. And I was really interested in exploring that and using motivational interviewing techniques with people in that moment digitally to really change the course of their health. And I really believed and still believe that that can be done. I learned over time that I was a clinician, an entrepreneur, and definitely not an academic. And that I was willing to give up or drastically reduce my clinical hours in order to focus on being an entrepreneur. And I think figuring out what mattered to me, what I learned was over time, I wanted to have big impact at a big, big scale. And that really did determine what I ended up doing with the company. So this is like a list of all my mistakes. I don't think we knew who would use it. I don't think we knew who would pay for it. We definitely had no idea how we would scale what we were doing. And the need, I think, was there is an urgent need to change patient behavior, but I don't think it's yet sort of proven in a way that it's easy to get in the front of the line in comparison to other urgent problems in healthcare. We did ultimately, I think, have a good story for why others couldn't do and what we'd learned from what we were doing that could be, that helped us sell the company. We were definitely a point solution. Our KPIs were constantly changing. You know, as I said, you can be a little delusional and look at your results and not be able to have a great sense. I found a great co-founder, someone Dr. Jarwala knows also. She was an early employee of the advisory board company, and she really helped me with the business part of the company. And the end game for us was an acquisition. So I'll talk a little bit about that. What we realized was that we had figured out something that was incredibly powerful, but we had only figured out how to do it at a very small scale. And we had learned a lot. We had, you know, I could tell you the story in a very kind of magical way. We started with our first pilot at Johns Hopkins. We had five marquee great clients. I had a co-founder from the advisory board. We raised $1.5 million. And we sold. We founded the company in 2012 and sold it in 2018 to Phreesia. And Phreesia went public in 2019. That story sounds amazing, but doesn't it all convey all the pain that, that happened along the way and all the mistakes? So a little bit about Phreesia and why I decided that they were the right acquisition partner. And also went against all the right things to do. I really was sure that Phreesia was the right acquisition partner for us. And although we had conversations with a bunch of different companies, what I saw in Phreesia was that they were the only company in the marketplace that had patient utilization that was really, really high. And I knew that what we were building needed patients to use it. You needed scale and you needed patients to use it to make a big difference. Phreesia is a patient intake company that, like checking in for your flight ahead of a visit, sends people messages ahead of their visit, and they go through a process of checking in and updating all their demographics, doing their consent forms and their co-pays. And what we thought is a company that can do this with 80% of patients, we would then be able to build on top of that solutions that would really solve some very important problems, like screening patients for social determinants of health, screening patients for behavioral health, some of the things we were working on, and activating patients around a lot of gaps in care. So that's how we decided to join Phreesia. A little bit about what became of us once we joined. So Phreesia is a platform. So they have products, a lot of patient-facing products, essentially, that deal with issues like collecting all that intake information, checking patients in before the visit, managing some patient-facing revenue cycle issues, helping patients get insurance verification, payment plans, keeping patients' cards on file, scheduling appointments. And if you look at the areas that I highlighted here, these were things that we started to build on top of that platform. So health campaigns to outreach to patients between their visits and when they were coming in for visits for other things that they had. So you're coming in for a sick visit and we'd say it looks like you're due for your mammogram or Medicare annual wellness visit. And we could outreach to patients and say, you're coming in for an upcoming appointment. You haven't gotten your A1C test done yet. Let's get that done right now. And then we started to build a lot of screening tools, which Phreesia had already started to sort of play with in that world. And we have expanded greatly the library of patient-reported outcomes and screening tools that we can deliver on the platform, and social determinants of health. So I'm going to jump forward and talk a little bit for a second about what happened during COVID, because that became for us an incredible opportunity to rapidly iterate on our product and build really kind of very interesting things. So once I joined, I started hiring. I hired two physicians on my team, one that was really gaps in care quality sort of focused person, and the other one focused on had SDOH expertise. And we started to work together so as a team, and we were able to, during COVID, build very quickly, starting in January this year, a screening tool to start engaging patients for COVID risk factors. And we changed it over time, and we've now screened, I think, 28 million patients across the country. So that was exactly the kind of big picture impact that I had always wanted, never thought it would happen in a pandemic. We realized the need for telehealth and were able to sort of help with the patient experience of getting patients into telehealth visits. We're not a telehealth company, but we're just reaching out to them, helping them with the instructions and the links to get into visits. And then constant communication with patients to tell them, how do you go to your visit now? There's no waiting room anymore. Chatting with them from the parking lot and building a lot of products to help make visits possible during COVID. And then we did a lot of outreach to patients to help providers rebuild their schedules. Two last things before I stop. Phreesia has been the KLAS patient intake solution leader the last 2 years, but we were especially recognized during COVID for being the top performer in our COVID response, which I'm incredibly proud of. And it's mostly due to having unbelievable client partners that worked with us, you know, night and day to help iterate on solutions, try and test things. If anyone says healthcare providers are sort of stuck in the mud or aren't willing to innovate, I've never seen so much innovation in such a short period of time during the pandemic. We also learned how to use our platform for data. I don't know if anyone's seen them, but we've been publishing reports since April, with Harvard and the Commonwealth Fund, looking at visit volume data across different specialties. And it really helped us think about our data in a different way. It was something Phreesia had never done before. But this all became sort of a part of my team's goal to help to Phreesia to really expand our expertise and provide a lot more clinical value than we had been previously. So I'll stop there and look forward to hearing the next presentation and taking questions later.
Thanks so much, Hillary. That was amazing. Really appreciate it. And thanks so much for your support as well.
Sure.
And I'd now like to introduce Dr. Girish Netkarni, who's a tenure track assistant professor in medicine nephrology and the clinical director of the Charles Bronfman Institute of Personalized Medicine. He completed his medical degree at one of the top-ranked medical colleges in India, and then received an MPH at the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health. Dr. Netkarni completed his residency in internal medicine and a clinical fellowship in nephrology at Mount Sinai, and then completed a joint research fellowship in nephrology and personalized medicine at the Charles Bronfman Institute of Personalized Medicine, where he was mentored by Dr. Erwin Bodinger. Dr. Netkarni has authored over 150 peer-reviewed scientific publications, including ones in the NEJM, Annals of Internal Medicine, and JAMA. He's received many awards, including the Best Outgoing Clinician Award, Dr. Harold N. Golden Lamport Research Award, and the Deal Year Award at Sinai Innovations. He's a principal or co-investigator for several NIH-funded grants. Dr. Netkarni is a scientific co-founder of two investor-backed companies, one of which, Renalytics AI, is listed on the NASDAQ Public Exchange. So, Girish, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Sunita, thank you so much for inviting me and for the amazing group and panel that you have put together. I'm also acutely aware that I'm the last barrier between you guys and a beer, so I'll try to be succinct as well as informative and acknowledging that those might not coincide. So I'm here to tell you the story of Renalytics AI and also, more importantly, present some of the problems and the data behind it. I'll start off. These are my disclosures, which I have to say. The problem statement is clear here, right? Chronic kidney disease for any clinician is a global health epidemic. You can read these numbers yourself. But if something isn't done, then it is planned to consume the Medicaid budget and Medicare budget very, very soon. And recently, and good for us, there's been a huge focus on a new war on kidney disease. Basically, they are making aggressive goals to reduce patients on dialysis by 2030. And there's a huge focus on the unsustainable health costs from diabetes, chronic kidney disease, and obesity, all of which are linked together. And there's a huge overlap between chronic kidney disease, diabetes, and cardiovascular disease. And it's just come into focus that chronic kidney disease management needs to be the center in order to prevent complications because of diabetes and heart failure and cardiovascular disease. But unfortunately, chronic kidney disease currently is the management is suboptimal, to not use colorful language here. Because if you look at it, chronic kidney disease has been divided into stages, and only around 18% of primary care physicians and only around 8% of patients have awareness of chronic kidney disease. It's understandable because it's a silent disease and you don't really have symptoms or signs until you reach like the end stages where you require dialysis or a transplant. And it's measured by numbers. So, it's understandable but not justifiable that patients as well as physicians do not have a strong awareness of chronic kidney disease. And CKD care in America sucks, for lack of a better word, because, if you look at this, most patients do not, the things that you can do to control chronic kidney disease are management of blood pressure, management of diabetes, newer medications like SGLT2 inhibitors help, but older medications like ACE or ARBs are also beneficial. So this is data from my friend Lekha Thummalapalli, which shows that, around 48% of patients have blood pressure at the required goal. Of only around 60% of patients do not have HbA1c's controlled. Only 36% of patients are on ACE or ARBs, and only 31% of patients are on appropriately statins. And there's huge PCP barriers to management of chronic kidney disease. The challenges include, there's a challenge quantifying the severity of chronic kidney disease. These are actual PCP quotes from a paper. There's a lack of familiarity with chronic kidney disease guidelines, and there's inconsistent screening. And the ADA and CKD has not made this more easier. There's what I call, or not me, but lots of people call analysis by paralysis, where there's so many guidelines and there's so many sort of algorithms that things have become more complicated rather than clear. I mean, I can't even read this with a straight face, but ultimately the goal is most patients with diabetes and chronic kidney disease could benefit from this. Some patients could benefit from SGLT2 inhibitors and RAS blocker, and very few patients could benefit from antiplatelet therapies. This is the current standard of managing chronic kidney disease, which is called a KDIGO heat map, which divides patients into groups based upon the GFR, which is a blood test where you calculate their kidney function from, and the albuminuria. And they get even more confusing when coming to diabetes management, because most patients do not have this measured, and most people have this measured, but it's hard to put patients into brackets if you are missing a bunch of tests. Either it's refer or treat, depending upon the color. The orange is refer and the treat is color. So I guess what I'm trying to say is that there is a lack of accurate risk stratification in chronic kidney disease and a lack of clear guidance about what to do with patients once the risk stratification was met. And we recognized this back in 2015. And there's a lot of, so we were working on better biomarkers for chronic kidney disease and better algorithms for accurate risk stratification. And this work would have been just left as an academic exercise. But then me with my scientific co-founder, Steve Coca, who was working on biomarkers and I was working on EHR data, decided to get together and do something about it. We quickly acknowledged the fact that we had no a history in running companies. We had no regulatory experience. So by happenstance, we managed to find Mr. James McCullough, who was a seasoned CEO in the diagnostics and data space and had run multiple companies in the past. And, we talked together and a foundational team came together where we decided to tackle this particular problem. And the problem was to treat risk stratification, and it was at the base of the chronic, the team-based integrated care for chronic kidney disease, where risk stratification is the cornerstone of everything. So these were the biomarkers I was mentioning, and I'll promise I'll be brief on the data piece of it. But I think it's important to understand the scientific rationale and the scientific basis behind any new company or any new product. So these biomarkers we've been working on for a while now. They are in the pathway for causing both kidney injury, and they're TNFR1, 2, and KIM1. And this is from a published paper, which shows that if no biomarkers are elevated versus of all three biomarkers are elevated, then the risk of developing a kidney outcome in diabetic kidney disease jumps from 6% to 5-fold to 33%. And so many studies have been published since then of on these biomarkers, which show strong, consistent results in the fact that these biomarkers or elevations of these biomarkers are always associated with an outcome in kidney disease. So now the challenge was to, you know, take what we know and actually apply it to clinical practice and to change the lives of patients, right? Which is always the roadblock in the translational pipeline. So what we did was we developed a product called as a Kidney Intellects, where a standard blood draw, which is what physicians do on a daily basis, we order blood draws on patients, can be combined with elements from the electronic health record, which is automatically pulled. So physicians don't have to go to a separate calculator and plug in numbers and harmonize this electronic data and actually come up with a simple, easy, and actionable score for kidney disease called as a Kidney Intellect score. So this is the data behind it. If everyone wants to read, it's been validated in two centers, both Biome Biobank, which is our institutional biobank, and UPenn. It improves your AUC versus a clinical model by 15 points. It improves the PPV in the high-risk group almost twofold, improves NPV, improves reclassification. People who have a high kidney intellect score have an almost 18-fold increase in the eventual kidney outcome as opposed to people who are in the low or the medium risk group. But more importantly, this provides a way of a simplified way of telling both the physicians and the providers about what to do of the kidney disease, right? It's a simple speedometer where you say that if your risk is high, then you need to act because they require more aggressive lifestyle changes, medication regimens, and immediate referrals. If the risk is low, then you don't, you're not out of the woods there, but you need to maintain and need to be monitored annually. And the intermediate risk group, they require more primary care follow-up and maybe needed to refer to a nephrologist. And this is a significant improvement over the current risk stratification metrics that we use, just showed earlier, the KDIGO, because it doubles the proportion of future patients that were flagged as high risk. So you have more confidence when you say that a patient is high risk, that the patient is actually going to be high risk. We've tied this at Mount Sinai to precision management strategies, where risk-based care navigation is offered to dedicated teams and education materials. And this is a cornerstone of care navigation and education, both on the patient front as the provider front. And this has encouraged both patient engagement and shared decision-making throughout the disease lifecycle. This is currently live at Mount Sinai, where patients have been tested, and the feedback is overwhelming from both patients and providers that instead of having to integrate all of this disparate information and then come to an accurate decision, they can have a simple score which helps them come to a more accurate decision. And patients also understand this much better because, you know, they know what the risk is of developing kidney failure in the few years. So I just want to paint a quick picture of the future, because right now we do this, which is we manage patients on dialysis or transplant, but there is an option to intervene early, move the CKD, diabetic kidney disease care upstream, and to prevent or slow progression of CKD. And this is graphically illustrated here, right? Because there's, you know, in early stages, there's a lack of PCP awareness, a lack of risk stratification, insufficient treatment, very late referral to the nephrologist, which ultimately leads to patients coming in to the emergency room without having seen a nephrologist ever and being started on dialysis with no preparation for it, which is an extremely traumatizing event to patients and their families. So if instead we do a kidney, you know, we can change this paradigm by having care navigators identify patients and order kidney intellects. We can risk stratify them early and stratify patients into low, medium, and high risk categories. We can treat them early by doing a recommended care path by education, diet, medications, or referrals. We can refer them early and have a care navigation team monitor the overall physician performance and patient performance and provide feedback. And ultimately, we can change this curve and, dare I say, bend this curve in order to prevent patients from eventually getting onto dialysis. Now, obviously, the outcome studies are ongoing right now, and we hope we anticipate this will show this trajectory of patients by preventing patients from getting to dialysis or transplant. So in the last few minutes, I'd like to give you an overview of how this happened. So when we started, we went to the FDA and we got a breakthrough device designation because we realized that someone had to pay for it. And through Medicaid, which had innovative pathway for new devices or solutions that integrate diverse sources, we got Medicaid coverage and a CPT code for it. So people we have state and clear authorized laboratories in UT Southwestern, University of Utah and New York. And we have a final FDA submission pending, and we are expected to be approved. We have several collaborations with large academic centers, including obviously Sinai, where this technology was conceived and adopted, Michigan, Yale, Hopkins. We have several collaborations with pharma companies, and the National Kidney Foundation, which is preparing our educational materials. And briefly, I'd like to discuss about the financing for the company. Early, we had sort of a divergent way in which we could have gone out and raised venture capital, but raising venture capital is, you know, it comes with sort of a lot of, you know, strings attached to it. It's not a fat capital structure. However, the alternative investments market at London allows you to raise capital at a very flat investment structure. So there is no sort of preferred stock or associated with it. We then conducted follow-on financing in July 2019, and finally in this year, amidst the COVID epidemic, we actually were double listed on the NASDAQ. So, you know, there are alternative ways in which you can raise money for an idea, especially if the idea and the penetration is good and you have a strong team behind it. And that's been just my experience because I honestly couldn't have done it alone. I had a good co-founder, Steve Coca. We had an amazing executive team led by James McCullough. And sort of that's been my experience with this particular company. Thank you again, Sumit, for the time. Thank you again for your attention, and I'm happy to take questions.
Girish, thank you so much. That was amazing. You know, really, very inspiring. Thank you very much for your time and for your amazing work.